Chapter 2. Sink or Swim. How we took the wrong lesson from the military. In 1954, Texas A&M was far from the cash-rich and athletic-hungry university that it's known as today. It was the Cow College, a men's-only school stuck in the past. As one student remarked of the time, the campus looked a little bit like a penitentiary. So when football coach Paul Bear Bryant picked up and left the University of Kentucky for Texas A&M, not only was it a surprise, but it provided hope for the university's fledgling football team. When Bryant stepped foot on the A&M campus, he knew he needed to make a change, and it was going to start with preseason camp. In the summer of 1954, Bryant and his team of nearly 100 players set out for the small Texas town of Junction, situated 140 miles west of Austin, or more precisely, in the middle of nowhere. The team was excitedly awaiting camp. As senior quarterback Elwood Kettler recalled, "There was supposed to be swimming, nice green grass. I was looking forward to it. I thought it was going to be like a vacation." Bryant had other ideas. He was determined to harden his team, to separate the quitters from the keepers, and to send the message that change was brewing in College Station. Junction provided the perfect backdrop. "The facilities were so sorry that just looking at the place would discourage you," Bryant later wrote. "And the fields they practiced on weren't much better. It wasn't a football field. It wasn't any kind of field," Dennis Goring recalled years later. "A blistering heat wave and one of the worst recorded droughts in the Texas Hill Country wreaked havoc on the small town. Practice was brutal," as Mickey Herskowitz reported for the Houston Post. "They had a full-scale scrimmage, the very first thing, and guys were throwing up all over the place." As camp wore on, player attrition mounted. The newspapers of the day even kept a tally. "Sixth player quits team at Texas A&M," read the headline in the Washington Post. Rob Roy Spiller, the bus depot attendant at the time, recalled players desperate to escape the training camp from hell. As the boys approached the depot, Spiller asked, "Where would y'all like to go this morning?" The typical reply, "We don't care. First bus out." By the end of the 10-day camp, by most accounts, between 27 and 35 players remained. Nearly 70 players had quit. Gene Stallings bluntly summarized the attrition in Jim Dent's classic book on the subject, The Junction Boys. "We went out there in two buses and came back in one." Bryant would go on to achieve legendary status in college football at the University of Alabama, winning 6 national championships and becoming one of the most revered coaches in history. Before he left for Alabama, Bryant did just what he said he would. He turned Texas A&M into a national title contender, going 9-0 in 1956. The Junction Boys camp was a central component to that success. It transformed the culture of a downtrodden team, developing a core nucleus of players who would overcome any obstacle. As Bob Easley, a fullback on the 1954 team, put it, "You go through 10 days of hell, and you go in as a boy, and you come out a man. Survive, and you thrive." The story of the Junction Boys has become a symbol for coaches and players everywhere. While harsh, the training camp was a rousing success. If you want to get the best out of a team, weed out the weak players and harden the remaining ones. Toughening up individuals was the secret to success. It's a story that's been memorialized in a best-selling book and an ESPN movie. It's a story that we've held on to as the blueprint for creating toughness. But that Junction Boys team, the 30-odd players who lasted, how did they fare that season? Their first game was a 9-41 drubbing from Texas Tech. The rest of the season didn't get much better. 1 win, 9 losses. Popular lore often overlooks their abysmal results that season and points to A&M's success 2 years later when they finished 9-0 in 1956. The Junction Boys camp has gone down in history as the focal point of the turnaround. But like most things, it's easier to assign attribution after the fact than to know the true cause. Only 8 players who survived the camp from hell played on the winning Texas A&M team 2 years later. John David Crow, a future Heisman Trophy winner, would serve as the backbone of the undefeated team, leading the team in touchdowns and yards. Crow was part of the Junction Boys team, but as a true freshman, he wasn't allowed to travel with the group to camp. The star quarterback for that same undefeated team? Jim Wright, another freshman who didn't go to Junction. Their All-American tackle, Charlie Kruger? Same story. He stayed at home. Years later, Ed Dudley, a member of the A&M team during the Bryant years, summed it up. Our freshmen in 1954 won the conference in 1956. The eight players who survived Junction played a large role, but so did another change at A&M. They landed blue-chip prospects. Through a combination of Bryant's skill and the help of bending and breaking recruiting rules, A&M got better talent to complement their core players. In his autobiography, Bryant explained, "That first year was brutal. We could hardly get anybody to come to A&M, and I know some of our alumni went out and paid a few boys." Better talent meant better results, regardless of how that talent was acquired. While tactics like those employed by Bryant have entered the sporting lore as a way to develop toughness, they were anything but. The camp wasn't about creating tough players. It was about sorting, separating the wheat from the chaff. And even that seemed to fail. Top recruits, future NFL players, and even a future war hero quit after Bryant's antics. The quitters included all Southwest Conference players Fred Broussard, who would go on to play in the NFL, and Joe Boring, who switched to baseball and led the Aggies to a conference title. It's tempting to paint the picture that those who survived did so because they were tougher, but that's too simplistic of a narrative. Foster Tudor Teague was one of the athletes who the papers of the day reported leaving camp due to injury. Teague became a Top Gun fighter for the Navy, flying the F-8 and F-4 fighters during Vietnam. His resume is littered with superlatives, including earning a Silver Star, commanding the aircraft carrier USS Kitty Hawk, and being selected as a pilot for a top-secret program to test out a Soviet MiG fighter. Gifted players like Teague, Broussard, and Boring didn't leave camp because they weren't able to handle it. Whether because of injury or priorities, mindless suffering in the dry heat lost its appeal. That's no more an indicator of their internal fortitude than an employee working long hours for a minimum wage resigning to find a better opportunity. And the players who lasted? They didn't do so out of some innate strength or resolve. Many did so because they had no other choice. Jack Pardee echoed a familiar refrain for those who made it through camp. "I never thought about quitting. If I did, where would I go?" Running back Bobby Drake Keith summed it up best. "A lot has been made about the ones who stuck it out being stronger or whatever. But I think most of us survived because football was important to us for whatever reason, and it was in our nature to do whatever we had to do to stay on the team and stay in school. Our instinct was survival." Success is complex. I'm not proclaiming that Bryant wasn't a great coach or teacher in many regards. But when it comes to developing toughness, we have to ask whether the Junction camp was successful or not. It accomplished precisely what Bryant wanted at the time, eliminating players after a coaching regime change. But did it develop toughness? The immediate performance gains, or lack thereof, suggest otherwise. And if it did work, then it did so for one-third of his team at best. It fundamentally failed the other two-thirds. Throw eggs at the wall. See which ones don't break. We need to outgrow this old model. Even Bryant did. At a 25-year reunion of the camp survivors, Bryant apologized to his former players, acknowledging that he had mistreated them. In his later years, he remarked that, "If it had been me, I'd have quit a dozen times, but they never quit. I didn't know if I was doing it right or not, but it was the only way I knew how to do it." Bryant's equating of handling extreme conditions with success has stuck around. Bryant and the story of the Junction Boys formed the basis of our model of toughness, setting the standard for how a generation defined it. It is, arguably, the origin story for this narrative, a Darwinian survival of the fittest trope that is taking place in homes and on athletic fields across the country. Siphon off the weak, let the strong remain. Those who survive will thrive. Those who don't make the cut, well, they could find something easier to do. No water, go until you puke. Harden players, develop thick skin. A sort of Machiavellian, the end justifies the means concept. How we got the toughness story wrong. Before Bryant was a football coach, he served in the Navy during World War II. The similarities between our common conception of military-style training and the Junction Boys' style of toughness is striking. But it's also wrong. The great irony is that the military doesn't use boot camps and similar exercises to develop toughness. In actuality, the military is at the forefront in developing real toughness, just not in the way that most of us imagine. We just took the wrong lessons. The Navy SEALs Hell Week wasn't designed as a method to toughen up and develop soldiers. Its goal was to separate those who could survive the rigor of war, to see who could handle the stress they were about to face, to see if, when in the foxhole, they could do their job. In sports, we took it as a means of development, and unfortunately, we made the same mistake off the playing field. We mistook the sorting portion of the military as development and looked right past how the military actually developed soldiers to survive extreme adversity. The old model of toughness, in essence, throws people into the deep end of the pool, but forgets that we need to first teach people how to swim. When we face extreme stress, we sometimes fall into a strange state where our perceptions shift, memory fades, and we're incapable of acting. In this case, we're not talking about the stress of giving a presentation, but a more harrowing kind of stress. Think soldiers in the midst of battle, emergency workers experiencing catastrophe, or the trauma of physical abuse. Psychologists refer to this experience as dissociation. Dissociation is the feeling of being detached, as if your mind has hit the eject button to get you through the experience. It can be separated into three categories: amnesia, depersonalization, feeling detached from self, and derealization, detaching from your surroundings. Our perceptions change. We forget, zone out, and feel incapable of action. It's an extreme involuntary coping strategy, a last-ditch effort for survival. And when you are in a life-or-death scenario, where the well-being of both yourself and those around you depends on you performing specific tasks, dissociation isn't the state you want to be in. Yet, that's the exact predicament our military faces: high stress and a need to perform. We tend to think of experienced soldiers as strong, stoic, and tough, and rightfully so. Yet, according to research, when put through extreme stress, 96% of the soldiers experience dissociative symptoms. 65% of experienced soldiers reported having lost track of what was going on. All but two of the 94 soldiers interviewed said they felt as if they were looking at the world through a fog. Not exactly the experience you want to be having when in the midst of combat and survival. While nearly all soldiers suffer from the fog of warlike conditions, not everyone falls deep into the throes of dissociation. Some soldiers can stay engaged and maintain a calm, clear head during even the moments of utmost stress. They are able to keep their cognitive wits. The fog is still there, but they find a way to navigate through it. To soldiers, this capacity means the life or death of not only themselves, but their entire squadron. The U.S. military desperately needed to train this ability. But how? During the first half of the 20th century, survival training was relatively simple and straightforward. Learn what to do if your plane goes down, how to survive extreme environments, and, if captured, hold out as best you can. It wasn't until after the mass casualties of POWs in the Korean War that survival training became strategic. In 1961, the Air Force opened their first survival school, with the Navy and Army following soon after. The SEER, Survival, Evasion, Resistance, and Escape program was born. There are three critical phases of survival training: classroom, evasion, and detention. The latter two are what receive most of the attention. Evasion involves getting dropped off in the wilderness with clear goals: evade actors dressed as enemies and survive off the land. Just as soldiers are getting used to foraging for food, they are captured, blindfolded, and whisked away for the final phase of their training. In a mostly classified POW experience, soldiers are locked away in cells and put through periodic physical and psychological beatings. One former Navy pilot reported having to endure a blaring speaker in the corner of the cell, a mind-numbing cacophony of an out-of-control saxophone was followed by Rudyard Kipling reciting his poem Boots over and over in a very haunting voice. Time spent in the cell is interrupted by interrogation sessions, which might include being stuffed into a box or another form of simulated torture, all while being told that your only way to safety and comfort is to disclose information. Detention is the part of SEER training that is dreaded by those who have to go through it and romanticized by those who hear about it. By all accounts, the experience feels real. Your mind believes your life is in danger. And it largely works in developing resilience. But it's the often overlooked first phase that distinguishes SEER training as a method of developing versus sorting. Before being dropped into the wilderness, soldiers are trained. The initial classroom phase consists of a barrage of lectures designed to give soldiers the skills necessary to survive, evade, and resist. The U.S. Air Force's SEER Operations Manual is 652 pages and covers everything from psychological aspects of survival to knowledge of medicine, methods of camouflage, fire making, and whatever in the world river hydraulics is. The psychology section includes how to handle boredom, loneliness, hopelessness, losing the will to survive, and over 24 other maladies. In other words, the goal of SEER training is to prepare you for just about anything that you'd face, all before you even set foot in the woods or a simulated POW camp. But aren't the harrowing conditions of the final two phases of training similar to a Junction Boys-style camp? The training isn't designed to push you to failure. It's to prepare you for a potential reality that you might face. SEER training is based on the concept of stress inoculation. If we vaccinate someone to extreme stress, they'll be able to handle it better. The first step isn't to throw someone into the deep end of extreme stress. It's teaching the skills necessary to cope with the situation. Without learning the skills, the second part, putting individuals in a harrowing environment to practice those skills, is useless. The key to stress inoculation, though, is like a real vaccine. You don't want it to be so powerful that you overwhelm the system. SEER was just the start. In the latter half of the 20th century, the military realized that making people do difficult things wasn't enough. Bear Bryant-style boot camps were great sorters, but poor teachers. In 1989, the U.S. Military Academy introduced the Center for Enhanced Performance, focusing on teaching cadets about goal setting, positive self-talk, and stress management. Soon after, programs in every branch of the military introduced mental skills coaching, culminating in nearly a dozen programs focused on improving mental strength and resilience. As of 2018, the U.S. Army is the largest employer of sports psychologists in the country. In 2014, the RAND Corporation was tasked with answering an important question: is the Air Force doing everything it can to prepare battlefield airmen to perform successfully under stressful conditions? In evaluating nearly a dozen methods of preparing soldiers for the stress they'd experience, there were two items sitting atop the list of recommendations. First, emphasizing core skills that aid performance, including confidence, goal setting, attention control, arousal control, imagery, self-talk, compartmentalization, and mental skills foundation. And second, ensuring those skills are mastered before exposure to stressful conditions. In other words, you need to teach the skill first. Even the vaunted Navy SEALs recognized this distinction when, in the early 2000s, they implemented a classroom phase designed to train candidates how to monitor their psychological performance and learn to maximize mental toughness skills. Research and practice are clear. Stress inoculation doesn't work unless you have acquired the skills to navigate the environment you will encounter. As sports psychologist Brian Zuliger told me, telling people to relax doesn't work unless you've taught people how to actually relax. The same goes for mental strength. The historical way to develop toughness was to do something physically challenging, and you'd have a 50-50 shot if they thrived. You have to teach the skill before it can be applied. Throwing people in the deep end doesn't work unless they've been taught the basics of how to swim. Let's take the vaccine analogy a little further. What happens if you don't inoculate yourself against the specific stress you end up facing? If, like with the yearly flu vaccine, the doctors and scientists select the wrong influenza viruses and load up the vaccine with a strain that only offers partial immunity to this year's version of the flu, are you out of luck? Destined to get severely sick and possibly die? Of course not. You have a backup, your immune system. A healthy and robust immune system can fight many circulating viruses that it has little prior knowledge about or immunity to. Our immune system has both a general response to any foreign invader and an adaptive response of specialized cells tuned toward targeting pathogens. The adaptive response works better at ensuring safety from a specific virus, but the general response gives you a last line of defense in case of emergency. Within these two responses are a variety of methods to deal with whatever enters our body, even if we've never seen it before. A tough individual is like a robust immune system. It's best to have knowledge to prepare for specific stressors. But even if we encounter an unfamiliar threat, we have a number of methods to cope with whatever comes our way. Recently, in the military, there's been a push for not only utilizing stress inoculation, but also building a robust foundation for all soldiers. Comprehensive Soldier Fitness, CSF, is a program designed to maximize a soldier's potential and face the physical and psychological challenges of sustained operations. Sustained is the key word there. If survival-style training is a vaccine, then CSF is maintaining a healthy and robust immune system. It focuses on developing resilience and skills to cope over the long haul. Militaries worldwide have adopted a strength-based approach to psychological development. As noted previously, developing a mental skills foundation was one of the key skills in the review on the Air Force's stress inoculation program. Pulling from the field of positive psychology, instead of focusing on preparing for the worst and shoring up weaknesses, such an approach teaches the basics of well-being and mental health, including learned optimism, resilience, post-traumatic growth, and emotion regulation. The goal is to develop skills that help handle the specific stresses on the battlefield and the stressors that hit us in everyday life. In 2015, the U.S. Army enacted the Human Dimension Strategy, aimed at developing the holistic person instead of the old model, which emphasized technical and tactical knowledge. Among the objectives for the program, intellectual optimization, social intelligence, holistic health and fitness, decision-making, and team-building. We took the wrong message from the military on toughness. No, it's not that we need to put athletes through ridiculous training or enact authoritarian control. It's not the discipline or demandingness we needed to copy. Not even the strength or machismo. We took the sorting to mean training. We saw the training, but forgot the teaching. We glossed over that the training wasn't hard for the sake of creating toughness. It was designed to simulate and train for the actual demands soldiers would face on the battlefield. The lesson wasn't that we just need to put people in difficult spots and force them to deal with adversity. We need to teach them how to navigate the discomfort they'll soon face. We took the lessons from the 1940s military, ignoring that even the military doesn't subscribe to the Bear Bryant model of toughness anymore. Toughness isn't a sorting exercise. We need to teach the skills to handle adversity. Development is not merely putting people through challenging times. As the military discovered, sink or swim doesn't work. When researchers evaluated soldiers who were able to keep a clear head during extreme stress, they found that the soldiers appraised stress as a challenge instead of a threat, thanks in large part to a better assessment of what they encountered. Utilized a diverse array of methods to cope with stress, demonstrating a high degree of cognitive flexibility. Processed internal signals better without reacting to them. And didn't react to negative stimuli, but instead were able to change their physiological state. In other words, soldiers were training their biology and psychology to work in tandem during challenging moments. It's not that they weren't experiencing discomfort. Instead, they had figured out ways to maintain clarity when everything around them was pushing them toward chaos. High performers are able to work their way through adversity and challenge with the same equanimity. When put in situations that require toughness, it's not that they are bulldozing through the experiences. They navigate them with grit and grace. The best of the best have another factor in common. No, it's not that they were born with extraordinary abilities to manipulate their inner world to handle adversity. It's not that they are immune to stress and anxiety so that they can work their way through situations easier than you or I. Their secret? When dealing with discomfort, they all want to quit. Under extreme levels of discomfort, our biology and psychology push even the toughest of us to give up. I surveyed dozens of authors, entrepreneurs, executives, soldiers, and athletes, nearly all having moments of wanting to throw their manuscript in the trash, debating ways to get out of their approaching deadline, or finding a hole to step in to end the misery of the race they are running. Negative thoughts of quitting are normal. They don't mean you are weak. They represent your mind trying to protect you. We all face an inner battle, a slew of feelings, emotions, and thoughts that push and pull us toward persevering through and throwing in the towel. Sometimes our inner world screams at us to quit. Sometimes it nudges us toward apathy and complacency. Jonathan Way, a prolific academic at the University of Arkansas who studies gifted education, described to me how he often loses this inner battle. I find myself staring off into space, avoiding writing and revising various papers and projects. I often side with the lower-hanging fruit. We all face similar pulls, and understanding this process is central to navigating it. Choosing the difficult path. It's Friday night. You're sitting in your apartment, waiting patiently. You have plans, or at least you think you do. Earlier in the day, your new love interest said he'd text early that evening to set up a date. 5 o'clock, 6, 7 all come and go without the familiar buzz of your phone indicating some sort of notification. A slight feeling of unease begins to creep through your body. Your shoulders tense as anxiety begins to build. These initial sensations act like a small blinking light on your car's dashboard, sending the signal to your running mind, "Hey, something is going on. Maybe I should pay attention to it." You brush it off. He's probably running late from work. He'll text soon. Meanwhile, glances toward your phone increase. Once every 15 minutes turns into every 5 minutes and finally becomes incessant checking. Early on, the TV provides a worthy distraction, but as the night wears on, your attention gravitates to that rectangular piece of technology that holds the key to modern communication. As unease turns into anxiety, your world narrows. Distraction fails. Your mind tunes to only one thing. The alarm inside your head shifts from blinking to blaring, from warning to impending disaster. A calm inner dialogue transforms into a raging internal debate. An angel and devil emerge, pushing and pulling us toward one action or another. Maybe I should text him. No, give him space. Maybe Snapchat him instead. That would be too needy. He said he would text, just wait. You feel like a lunatic, spiraling out of control in an illogical fight against yourself. Your imagination runs wild, and visions of him standing you up, or maybe even ditching you for another date, surface. You've spiraled into a full-blown freakout. At this point, your inner turmoil moves toward actual behavior. Barrages of texts or calls to your lost love interest soon follow. We've all been there, men and women alike. It started innocently enough with an expectation that he or she would text. From there, it spiraled down, 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 until we've become an irrational mess. We've transformed from respected adult professional to the despairing depths of our teenage years. We are a wreck. Whether you're trying to resist the pull to quit or barraging your potential lover with texts, the key to toughness lies in navigating this biological and psychological cacophony. I've hinted at this sequence throughout this chapter, but let's clearly define it. How do we get from discomfort to action? Feeling leads to inner debate, which leads to an urge, which in turn leads to a decision: freak out or find our way through. We experience some sort of sensation or feeling while our mind runs rampant with internal thoughts that push and pull us in different directions. Both our feelings and thoughts nudge or urge us towards some sort of decision. To quit, persist, or change our goals before we ultimately make a decision. Instead of seeing these as distinct steps, see them as a mishmash that work together. Sometimes we can distinguish each experience, feeling sad, then thinking about it, then having an urge to act because of it. Other times we jump straight from the slightest sensation to a decision. But each segment affects the rest. A touch of fear can spiral out of control if accompanied by a rash of what-if thoughts. When we're exhausted or experiencing high levels of stress and anxiety, we're more likely to take the quick route, finding an exit in whatever way possible. We choose the easiest path. According to the latest scientific theories, the brain functions to maintain order. Our brain is an uncertainty-reducing machine, willing to do whatever it takes to minimize surprise, even if it is at a high cost. Whenever we face something that throws our internal state off kilter, we go about trying to solve it. We seek out a solution that moves disorder to order. Sometimes that means giving up, such as when we are a third of the way through a project and can't see the finish on the horizon. We often quit so that the unknown becomes the known. Other times it means changing our expectations before even beginning a task. Or it could mean exploring, accepting, or avoiding whatever it is that has led to unease or discomfort. Uncertainty demands a conclusion. We have an innate need for closure, however we can reach it. Toughness is about making the pull for closure amid uncertainty work with you, not against you. It's training the mind to handle uncertainty long enough so that you can nudge or guide your response in the right direction. To create space so that you don't jump straight from unease to the quickest possible solution, but to the correct one. The first step in redefining toughness is to understand where we went wrong, why bulldozing through often leads to a worse outcome. In the rest of this book, we will unpack the pillars that allow us to address every part of this cycle, from what we feel all the way to the decision we make. The first pillar of toughness. Ditch the facade, embrace reality.